page 5. Somewhere in the first 5 minutes of a well-structured screenplay, someone, usually not the main character, will pose a question or make a statement, usually to the main character, that is the theme of the movie. "Be careful what you wish for," this person will say, or "pride goeth before a fall," or "family is more important than money." It won't be this obvious. It will be conversational, an offhand remark that the main character doesn't quite get at the moment, but which will have far-reaching and meaningful impact later. This statement is the movie's thematic premise. In many ways, a good screenplay is an argument posed by the screenwriter, the pros and cons of living a particular kind of life, or pursuing a particular goal. Is a behavior, dream, or goal worth it? Or is it false? What is more important, wealth or happiness? Who is greater in the overall scheme of things, the individual or the group? And the rest of the screenplay is the argument laid out, either proving or disproving the statement, and looking at it, pro and con, from every angle. Whether you're writing a comedy, a drama, or a sci-fi monster picture, a good movie has to be about something. And the place to stick what your movie is about is right up front. Say it, out loud, right there. If you don't have a movie that's about something, you're in trouble. Strive to figure out what it is you're trying to say. Maybe you won't know until your first draft is done. But once you do know, be certain that the subject is raised right up front. Page 5 is where I always put it. But make sure it's there. It's your opening bid. Declare, "I can prove it." Then set out to do so. Setup, pages 1 through 10. The first 10 pages of the script, or first dozen pages at most, is called the setup. If you're like me and like most readers in Hollywood, this is the make-or-break section, where you have to grab me or risk losing my interest. Think of all the good setups you've seen in the first reel, the first 10 minutes, which sets up the hero, the stakes, and goal of the story, and does so with vigor. The setup is also the place where, if you're me, the writer, I make sure I've introduced or hinted at introducing every character in the A story. Watch any good movie and see. Within the first 10 minutes, you meet or reference them all. Make sure by your page 10, you have done the same. The first 10 pages is also where we start to plant every character tick, exhibit every behavior that needs to be addressed later on, and show how and why the hero will need to change in order to win. She's an isolated writer who lives in a make-believe world, romancing the stone. He's a hip, slick, and savvy foreign car importer who's as glib as he is cold, Rain Man. She's a ditzy airhead who doesn't appear to have much substance, Legally Blonde. And when there's something that our hero wants or is lacking, this is the place to stick the 6 things that need fixing. This is my phrase. 6 is an arbitrary number that stands for the laundry list you must show, repeat, show, the audience of what is missing in the hero's life. Like little time bombs, these 6 things that need fixing, these character ticks and flaws, will be exploded later in the script, turned on their heads and cured. They will become running gags and callbacks. We, the audience, must know why they're being called back. Look at Big and its primary setup. You have to be this tall to go on this ride. On the list of 6 things that need fixing, there are other needs besides a height requirement. The kid in Big can't get the girl, have any privacy, etc. But in Act 2, he gets all those things when he magically turns big. And those callbacks only work because we have seen them in the setup. Geez, but that's a lot of stuff to do in the first 10 pages. But there it is. If you want to play with the big boys, these are the tasks you must accomplish. One last word on the setup as it relates to Act 1. I like to think of movies as divided into 3 separate worlds. Most people call these 3 acts. I call them thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. The first 10 pages and the rest of Act 1 is the movie's thesis. It's where we see the world as it is before the adventure starts. It is a full-fledged documentation of the hero's world labeled before. There is a calm before the storm in this world, and especially in the setup. If events that follow did not occur, it would pretty much stay this way. But there is a sense in the setup that a storm's about to hit, because for things to stay as they are is death. things must change. Catalyst, page 12. The package that arrives in Romancing the Stone, which will send Joan Wilder, Kathleen Turner, to South America, the telephone call that informs Tom Cruise his father has died in Rain Man, the dinner at which Reese Witherspoon's fiancé announces he's dumping her in Legally Blonde. These are the catalyst moments. Telegrams, getting fired, catching the wife in bed with another man, news that you have 3 days to live, the knock at the door, the messenger. In the setup, you, the screenwriter, have told us what the world is like, and now, in the catalyst moment, you knock it all down. Boom. I frankly love the catalyst moment, and I really miss it when I don't see it done or done well. Have to have it. Like my pet peeve, the lack of decent save-the-cat scenes in hip-slick movies. This is another one that bugs me when it's not there. I like the catalyst moment because it's life. Those moments happen to all of us, and life-changing events often come disguised as bad news. Like many of the beats in the BS2, the catalyst is not what it seems. It's the opposite of good news, and yet by the time the adventure is over, it's what leads the hero to happiness. When I'm writing a screenplay, my catalyst moment will float around for the first couple of drafts. The setup will be too long. The story is clogged with details, and that page 12 catalyst beat is somehow mysteriously on page 20. Well, cut it down and put it where it belongs, page 12. And when you start trimming all your darlings away, you'll suddenly realize that's why we have these little structure maps. All that boring detail was redundant, or you weren't very good about showing it economically. The catalyst point is the first moment when something happens. Thank God, and if it's not there, the reader will get antsy. Your coverage will read, no plot, because you'll have lost the reader's attention. Page 12, catalyst, do it. Debate, pages 12 to 25. This is a section of the script between pages 12 and 25 that used to really baffle me. When the telegram comes on page 12 informing me that my sister is being held by pirates, I know what I have to do. So why do I, the writer, have to vamp to the act break until my hero does what he's supposed to? The debate section is just that, a debate. It's the last chance for the hero to say, this is crazy, and we need him or her to realize that. Should I go? Dare I go? Sure, it's dangerous out there, but what's my choice? Stay here? My writing partner, Sheldon Bull, and I have been working on our Golden Fleece movie. In Act One, a kid is kicked out of military school and sent home to find his parents have moved. Well, the kid's stuck. He can't go back to military school, and he can't stay where he is. He knows where his parents moved to, so now it's a decision. Should he go on the road to find them? This is our chance to show how daunting a feat this is going to be. Can you imagine? But since it's a comedy, we've also made it funny. Our kid hero is taken to the edge of town at the end of Act One by a friendly cabbie. The kid looks ahead to a spooky-looking road down which he knows he must travel if he is to find his folks. Gulp. But his fear is quickly made light of when he's heckled by a driver passing by. And so, on a fun note, and making a firm decision, off he goes. Your moment of truth may not be so clear-cut, but it's important to remember that the debate section must ask a question of some kind. In Legally Blonde, the catalyst of the fiancé dumping Elle Woods quickly segues to her solution, go to Harvard Law. But can she get in? That is the question posed in the debate section of that movie. The debate section thus becomes showing how Elle answers that question, and when she manages to zoom her LSATs, create a lascivious admissions video, and get accepted, the answer to the question is clear. Yes. And like the kid hero in our Home Alone on the Road movie, Elle can happily march into Act Two. She has answered the debate question and can now proceed. Break into Two, page 25. It happens on page 25. I have been in many arguments. Why not page 28? What's wrong with 30? Don't, please. In a 110-page screenplay, it happens no later than 25. Page 25 is the place where I always go to first in a screenplay someone has handed me. We all have our reading quirks, to see what happens on 25. I want to know, one, if anything happens, and two, if this screenwriter knows that something should happen, and I mean something big, because that's what is supposed to happen on 25. As discussed above, the act break is the moment where we leave the old world, the thesis statement, behind, and proceed into a world that is the upside-down version of that, its antithesis. But because these two worlds are so distinct, the act of actually stepping into Act Two must be definite. Very often when I'm writing a screenplay, my act break will start off vaguely. I'll find that events will draw the hero into Act Two. This is incorrect. The hero cannot be lured, tricked, or drift into Act Two. The hero must make the decision himself. That's what makes him a hero anyway, being proactive. Take Star Wars. The event that prompts Luke Skywalker on his journey is his parents being killed, but the decision to go on the road is his. Luke cannot wake up on Han Solo's starship wondering how he got there. He has to choose to go. Make sure your hero does likewise. B story, page 30. The B story begins on page 30, and the B story of most screenplays is the love story. It is also the story that carries the theme of the movie. I also think that the start of the B story, what takes place around page 30, is a little booster rocket that helps smooth over the shockingly obvious A story act break. Think about it. You've set up the A story. You put it into motion. Now we've had this abrupt jump into Act 2, and you've landed in a whole new world. The B story says, enough already, how about talking about something else? Which is why the cutaway is usually in line with the A story, but new in scope. The B story gives us a breather. Let's take Legally Blonde, for instance. The B story is Elle's relationship with a manicurist she meets in Boston. And it is a much-needed break from the A story. We've met Elle. She's been dumped. She's decided to go to law school. She gets there, and school is tough. Well, enough already. Let's have a little time out. Let's go slightly off theme here and meet someone new. Thus the manicurist. And yes, while it's not a traditional boy-girl love story, it is in fact the love story. It's where Elle will be nurtured. It is also the place where Elle confides what she is learning in the School of Hard Knocks she's experiencing at Harvard Law, and the place from which she'll draw the strength she needs for the final push into Act 3, an ultimate victory. The B story is also very often a brand new bunch of characters. We have not always met the B story players in the first 10 pages of the screenplay. We did not even know they existed, but since Act 2 is the antithesis, they are the upside-down versions of those characters who inhabit the world of Act 1. Again, the B-story ally in Legally Blonde is a perfect example. Isn't Jennifer Coolidge, the wonderful actress who portrays manicurist Paulette Bonafonte, the funhouse mirror version of the girls from Elle's sorority house back at UCLA? This is why the character is so successful. She is a classic anti-thesis creature. The B story then does a lot, and you must have one. It provides not only the love story and a place to openly discuss the theme of your movie, but gives the writer the vital cutaways from the A story, and it starts on 30. Fun and Games, pages 30 to 55. The Fun and Games section is that part of the screenplay that I like to say provides the promise of the premise. It is the core and essence of the movie's poster. It is where most of the trailer moments of a movie are found. And it's where we aren't as concerned with the forward progress of the story, the stakes won't be raised until the midpoint, as we are concerned with having fun. The Fun and Games section answers the question, why did I come to see this movie? What about this premise, this poster, this movie idea is cool? When you, the development exec, asks for more set pieces, this is where I put them. In the Fun and Games. This to me is the heart of the movie. When I discovered what this section of the screenplay needs to do and why it's there, it leapfrogged me ahead 10 places. For me, it happened in the summer of 1989. It was a definite huzzah moment that is rarely so clear. When I was writing my very first draft of Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, I was sort of stuck. I had this great premise, which was Dirty Harry gets a new partner, his mother. But what was that? What was that movie about? What were the dynamics of the comedy? Many of you, I'm sure, are still asking. Then one day, I was sitting up in my office in the Fithian building in Santa Barbara, California, and I had a great idea. The World's Slowest Chase What if Joe the cop and his mom are shot at by bad guys? And what if they give chase? But what if, instead of Joe jumping behind the wheel and driving, his mom does, and she drives like a mom, complete with holding her arm across Joe's chest when they stop at all the stop signs? When I sold my script and went to my first meeting at Universal, the executive told me that when he read that scene, that's when he decided to buy my script. Why? Because that's when he knew there was something to this idea. I had delivered on the promise of the premise. And where did I put that great set piece? Right where it belonged, in the fun and games section of the screenplay. This goes for drama as well. The fun and games in Die Hard show Bruce Willis first outwitting the terrorists. The fun and games in Phone Booth occur when Colin Farrell realizes the seriousness of his predicament. We take a break from the stakes of the story and see what the idea is about. We see the promise of the premise and need not see anything else. I also call it fun and games because this section is lighter in tone than other sections. So Jim Carrey gets to walk around and act like God and Bruce Almighty. And Tobey Maguire gets to try out his oddly onanistic superpowers in Spider-Man. It's also where the buddies in all buddy movies do their most clashing. Get it? Fun and games. Learn it. Love it. Live it. Midpoint, page 55. There are two halves in a movie script, and the midpoint on page 55 is the threshold between them. We can talk about the importance of the two act breaks, but to me the midpoint is as important, especially in the early going of laying out a script's beats. I have found, in reviewing hundreds of movies, that a movie's midpoint is either an up, where the hero seemingly peaks, though it is a false peak, or a down, when the world collapses all around the hero, though it is a false collapse, and it can only get better from here on out. When you decide which midpoint your script is going to require, it's like nailing a spike into a wall, good and hard. The clothesline that is your story can now be strung securely. I made the discovery of how important this midpoint moment is quite by accident. In the early days of my movie writing career, I used to audiotape movies so I could listen to them in my car when I drove back and forth to meetings between Santa Barbara and L.A. The bargain basement tapes I bought, I was dead flat broke at the time, had 45 minutes on each side. By coincidence, the drive between Santa Barbara and Los Angeles is divided evenly by a mountain overpass at exactly the midpoint of the drive. 45 minutes from starting each trip, as I hit the top of that hill, side A of each tape ended, and I had to turn it over to the other side. One night I taped the old comedy classic, What's Up, Doc?, directed by Peter Bogdanovich, and starring Ryan O'Neal and Barbara Streisand. And I discovered the next day, as I topped the mountain crest, that the movie was perfectly evenly divided into two halves, and that its midpoint was a down. The first half of What's Up, Doc? Ends as fire envelops O'Neill's hotel room. A slow fade brings us to the next day as he wakes up a broken man and finds Barbara Streisand waiting to help him. The fire was, after all, her fault. Imagine the revelation I experienced as I topped the mountain pass and the first half of What's Up, Doc? That I had taped came to an end. The movie had two even halves. The power and the purpose of a strong midpoint was forever clear to me. After that, I began to see how many movies had midpoints that changed the whole dynamic of the film. But the midpoint does more than present an up or down. You will hear the phrase, the stakes are raised at the midpoint in a lot of script meetings, because they are. It's the point where the fun and games are over. It's back to the story. It's also the point where if you have a false victory where, say, the hero has been given an out-of-the-bottle bit of magic, he gets everything he thinks he wants. But it's a false victory because the hero has a ways to go before he learns the lesson he really needs. It just seems like everything's great. The midpoint has a matching beat in the BS2 on page 75 called All is Lost, which is described as false defeat. These two points are a set. It's because the two beats are the inverse of each other. The rule is, it's never as good as it seems to be at the midpoint, and it's never as bad as it seems at the All is Lost point. Or vice versa. In the What's Up, Doc? Example, Ryan O'Neal actually wins the coveted prize at the All is Lost moment on page 75. But it is a false victory, tainted by the rogues' gallery of crooks descending on the award ceremony and setting the action of Act 3 into motion. The midpoint and all his lost moments of What's Up Doc represent those for a down midpoint. The midpoint is either false victory or false defeat, and the all is lost is the opposite of it. Don't believe me? Check out the movies you rented in your genre and see if this midpoint, all is lost axis, isn't in every single one. Bad Guys Close In, pages 55 to 75. The section of script from page 55 to page 75, the midpoint to the all is lost, is the toughest part of the screenplay. There's a hard bit of truth for you. It never fails to be the most challenging for me, and there's no method to get through it other than to just muscle your way. This is where your skills as a bullhead come in handy. The term bad guys close in applies to the situation the hero finds himself in at midpoint. All seems fine, but even though the bad guys, be they people, a phenomenon, or a thing, are temporarily defeated, and the hero's team seems to be in perfect sync, we're not done yet. This is the point where the bad guys decide to regroup and send in the heavy artillery. It's the point where internal dissent, doubt, and jealousy begin to disintegrate the hero's team. I've never had an easy time with bad guys close in. It's the weakest part of Blank Check, and Colby and I were convinced at the time that it was fatal to our story. While writing a teen comedy called Really Mean Girls with Sheldon Bull, we had a similarly hard time with this section. Not to mention the fact that we didn't know Tina Fey was writing Mean Girls already. In our very similar story, four underdog girls decide to fight back against the evil blonde alpha females in their high school. By midpoint, they have out-bitched them, sent the Mean Girls packing, and become the superior clique in school. Well, now what? Sheldon and I didn't have a clue. We answered that question after a lot of painful think time by going back to the basics. The evil girls naturally regroup. We even wrote a very funny scene where we see them do that. Then internal dissent among our heroes begins. Popularity starts to go to their heads. Each begins to take credit for their victory, and the question of who is the most popular divides them. By all is lost, it's the reverse of the way it is at midpoint. The evil girls resume their rightful place, and our heroes depart the field in shame. All is really lost. That simple dynamic took us weeks to figure out. It only seems obvious now. Until we solved it, we didn't know. That is a classic example of what should happen in the bad guys close-in section of any script. The forces that are aligned against the hero, internal and external, tighten their grip. Evil is not giving up, and there is nowhere for the hero to go for help. He is on his own and must endure. He is headed for a huge fall. And that brings us to All is Lost, page 75. As addressed above, the All is Lost point occurs on page 75 of a good, well-structured screenplay. We know it is the opposite of the midpoint in terms of an up or a down. It's also the point of the script most often labeled false defeat. For even though all looks black, it's just temporary. But it seems like a total defeat. All aspects of the hero's life are in shambles. Wreckage abounds. No hope. But here's my little trade secret that I put into every All is Lost moment just for added spice. And it's something that many hit movies have. I call it the whiff of death. I started to notice how many great movies use the All is Lost point to kill someone. Obi-Wan in Star Wars is the best example. What will Luke do now? All is Lost is the place where mentors go to die, presumably so their students can discover they had it in them all along. The mentor's death clears the way to prove that. But what if you don't have an Obi-Wan character? What if death isn't anywhere near your story? Doesn't matter. At the All is Lost moment, stick in something, anything that involves a death. It works every time. Whether it's integral to the story or just something symbolic, hint at something dead here. It could be anything. A flower in a flower pot, a goldfish, news that a beloved aunt has passed away. It's all the same. The reason is that the All is Lost beat is the Christ on the cross moment. It's where the old world, the old character, the old way of thinking dies, and it clears the way for the fusion of thesis, what was, and antithesis, the upside-down version of what was, to become synthesis, that being a new world, a new life. and the thing you show dying, even a goldfish, will resonate and make that all-is-lost moment all the more poignant. You'd be surprised where this truism shows up. In the comedy hit Elf, starring Will Ferrell, the filmmakers stick exactly to the BS2, and there is even a moment where the whiff of death is clearly seen. In that story about a human, Will, raised as an elf in Santa Claus's North Pole, Will comes to New York to find his real dad, James Caan. The hilarious upside-down world of Act Two includes a classic antithesis character, Will's love interest, who is working as a fake elf in a department store at Christmas time. But later, when it all goes to hell one night for poor Will, when his real father rejects him and the world gets too complicated, we even have a death moment at page 75. Will pauses on a city bridge and, looking out at the water way below, clearly contemplates suicide. When I saw this film in the theater, I practically yelled out, "See? Whiff of death," but managed to restrain myself. And yet there it was, plain as day. Take a look at your dozen movies you've screened and find the all-is-lost point. Does it have the whiff of death in some aspect? Most certainly it will. All good primal stories must have this. It resonates for a reason. Dark Night of the Soul, pages 75 to 85. So now you're in the middle of a death moment, at the all-is-lost point. But how does your character experiencing this moment feel about it? This question is answered in a section of the screenplay I call Dark Night of the Soul. It can last 5 seconds or 5 minutes, but it's in there. And it's vital. It's the point, as the name suggests, that is the darkness right before the dawn. It is the point just before the hero reaches way deep down and pulls out that last best idea that will save himself and everyone around him. But at the moment, that idea is nowhere in sight. I don't know why we have to see this moment, but we do. It's the, "Oh Lord, why hast thou forsaken me" beat. I think it works because once again it's primal. We've all been there, hopeless, clueless, drunk, and stupid, sitting on the side of the road with a flat tire and 4 cents, late for the big appointment that will save our lives. Then and only then, when we admit our humility and our humanity and yield our control of events over to fate, do we find the solution. We must be beaten and know it to get the lesson. The dark night of the soul is that point. It's in comedies and dramas because it's real and we all identify. And in a good, well-structured screenplay, it's in there between pages 75 and 85. And thank God, because by page 85, when the hero finally figures it out, we get to see him realize, break into three, page 85. Huzzah, the solution! Thanks to the characters found in the B story, the love story, thanks to all the conversations discussing theme in the B story, and thanks to the hero's last best effort to discover a solution to beat the bad guys who've been closing in and winning in the A story, lo, the answer is found. Both in the external story, the A story, and the internal story, the B story, which now meet and intertwine, the hero has prevailed, passed every test, and dug deep to find the solution. Now all he has to do is apply it. The classic fusion of A and B is the hero getting the clue from the girl that makes him realize how to solve both, beating the bad guys and winning the heart of his beloved. An idea to solve the problem has emerged. The world of synthesis is at hand. Finale, pages 85 to 110. The finale is Act 3. This is where we wrap it up. It's where the lessons learned are applied. It's where the character ticks are mastered. It's where A story and B story end in triumph for our hero. It's the turning over of the old world and a creation of a new world order, all thanks to the hero, who leads the way based on what he experienced in the upside-down antithetical world of Act Two. The finale entails the dispatching of all the bad guys in ascending order. Lieutenants and henchmen die first, then the boss. The chief source of the problem, a person or thing, must be dispatched completely for the New World Order to exist. And again, think of all the examples in the movies you've screened of how this is true. The finale is where a new society is born. It's not enough for the hero to triumph. He must change the world. The finale is where it happens, and it must be done in an emotionally satisfying way. Final image, page 110. As stated earlier, the final image in a movie is the opposite of the opening image. It is your proof that change has occurred and that it's real. If you don't have that final image or you can't see how it applies, go back and check your math. There is something not adding up in Act 2. Summary. So, now that I've laid out these 15 beats for you and used examples like, "What's up, Doc?" I'm sure all you hip young screenwriting whippersnappers are saying, "Yeah, right, old man. Maybe this applied in your day, but we don't need it anymore. We eschew the need to like a hero. We dig Lara Croft. And those boring old story beats are passé. Who needs them? What about Memento?" Have I grasped the basic gestalt of your objection? If so, and though I've tried to pepper my examples with many newer movies, like Legally Blonde, you still may not believe me when I say this stuff applies. Still. Always. So, for you naysayers who say nay, let me use an example from my genre, PG comedy, that shows how these beats apply in the modern world you need to master. Oh, and by the way, screw Memento. Let's use a $100 million box office hit. Would that satisfy you? Let's look at a great poster and logline with a great star that satisfies all the beats in the BS2. Let's take a look at the Sandra Bullock comedy, Miss Congeniality. To start, it's got a great title, and its logline, an ugly duckling FBI agent goes undercover as a contestant to catch a killer at the American Miss pageant, certainly satisfies the four elements from Chapter 1. Irony, compelling picture, audience and cost, and a killer title. Let's see if it beats out according to the BS2. Miss Congeniality, a $100 million hit comedy in 15 beats. Opening image. Miss Congeniality opens on Sandra Bullock's character in flashback as a playground tough. The image is Sandra surrounded by boys. Sandra is a tomboy, and she's beating them up. Sandra has issues. When we cut to the present, Sandra is still surrounded by boys, still a tomboy, but she's an FBI agent, at home in the world of men. Kind of. Theme stated. When Sandra declares that she doesn't need to worry about being feminine because she's an FBI agent, that statement is the movie's theme. But is the statement true? We shall see. The movie will explore the subject of femininity. It is an essay on the pros and cons of being tough and a woman. Can you be both? That's what this movie is about. The setup. By page 10, we have met everyone who will appear in the A story of the movie and set up the world. We've met Benjamin Bratt, whom Sandra kind of likes. But she is off his radar. He likes classy girls that Sandra scoffs at. We also meet Sandra's boss, Ernie Hudson, and the world of the FBI. It's tough, a boys' club, and Sandra fits right in. And though she is a wheezing nerd with bad hair and no social life, she seems happy. A classic setup. With a sense, a storm's about to hit. It can't stay like this. Stasis equals death. Catalyst. A classic call to adventure. News comes that there's been a murder threat at the American Miss pageant. We also meet those in charge of the pageant, Candace Bergen and her son, and their Burt Parks, William Shatner and his hairpiece, and a very sporty model it is. To stop the murders, they hatch a plan that calls for a female agent to go undercover as a contestant. After going through a database of every available female FBI agent, they pick Sandra. Debate. But can she pull it off? That is the debate question of this section. It is answered after several funny moments with Sandra's mentor, Michael Caine, who agrees to take on the challenge of turning Sandra into a sexy girl. Break into two. Sandra strides from her makeover looking hot, hot, hot in her miniskirt. Even Benjamin is impressed. Then she stumbles. This isn't going to be easy, but Sandra is ready to try. So let the act break and act two begin. Fun and games. Classic promise of the premise, including all those funny trailer moments where a pistol-packing FBI agent is undercover at the American Miss pageant. Sandra's water glass talent show demonstration ends as she leaps off the stage to nab a suspect, etc. The fish is out of water and the clash leads to jokes. This is why we came to this movie. This is what lured us when we saw the poster. And it's fun. B story. The love story here is actually between Sandra and the girl contestants. Why? because the theme of the movie is about femininity and Sondra does not know this world. It is full of funhouse mirror versions of femininity. Each contestant has a talent and a quirk, and each, to Sondra's surprise, needs and likes her. It is Sondra's interaction with the girls of Girl World that carries the message of the picture and is its heart. And while Sondra also gets to kiss Benjamin by the movie's end, it will be because of the girls that she learns and grows and discovers her feminine side. Midpoint. The fun and games are over as a new threat to the pageant is announced and Sondra's stakes are raised. We've seen all the fun stuff, Sondra and her water glasses, met the suspects, had the joy of watching a tomboy interact with a girl she once thought odd. Now the real trouble starts. Bad guys close in. Sondra's doubts about her femininity grow, her conflict with her mentor deepens, and in this case, actual bad guys move closer, unseen in the shadows of the pageant. Though no one has died, there's a list of suspects. All is lost. Told by her boss to stand down, Sondra refuses. She has a lead on a suspect. But her boss delivers an ultimatum, either quit the case or be fired. Sondra chooses to stay on at the pageant. Thus, she has reached a classic all is lost moment. She is worse off than when this movie started. The whiff of death is the death of her identity. Without being the girl with the badge, who is she? Not even her mentor, Kane, can help. But he does give her a last weapon. A new dress. Dark night of the soul. Sondra arrives for the pageant finale and is a total mess. She's lost in the nether world of being neither FBI agent nor full-fledged woman. What to do? Break into three. With help from friends she's made in Girl World, Sondra is put back together by the other contestants for the pageant finale. Embraced by what was once foreign to her and confident that the girls really care, Sondra is revived. By helping Sondra, the girls also help themselves. Finale. The pageant itself. A classic bit of synthesis occurs when Sondra hangs in during the talent portion of her show by using her FBI skills on stage with Benjamin. The two worlds are fused together, answering the question raised and theme stated. Yes, she can be both tough and sexy. Sondra now catches the bad guys, Candace and her son. Candace's warped view of her own femininity is what caused her to sabotage the pageant. Sondra has proven herself to be a woman among women, and she's brought the bad guys to justice. Final image. Miss Congeniality closes with the opposite of the opening image. Sondra is surrounded by women. Sondra is awarded the coveted Miss Congeniality Award by her fellows. Quite a change. The real happy ending? $100 million in domestic box office. Now that you know that it works, you'll start to see how these beats can apply to your script. Exercises. 1. Type up the BS2 and carry it with you everywhere. Whenever you have an idle moment, think about a favorite movie. Can the beats of that movie fit into neat one-sentence descriptions of each of the 15 blanks? 2. Go back to Blockbuster. Boy, are they tired of you by now. And check out the 6 to 12 movies in the genre of the movie you're writing. Sit and watch as the beats of these films are magically filled into the blanks of the BS2. 3. For extra credit, look at Memento. Yes, it's an entertaining movie. Yes, it even falls into the category of genre dude with a problem. Does it also match the beats of the BS2? Or is it just a gimmick that cannot be applied to any other movie? Hint, for all the hullabaloo surrounding Memento, guess how much it made. And if you want to seriously debate the value of Memento in modern society, please go ahead and contact me at the email address provided in Chapter 1. But be ready for one hell of an argument from me. I know how much Memento made. Chapter 5. Building the Perfect Beast. If we are very lucky, we find a guru. These are people we meet along the way that have more wisdom than we do, and to our surprise, offer to share what they know. Mike Chitta is the first guru I met in the screenwriting business, and for 20 years he has continued to amaze me with his ability to spot, understand, and fix the problems of any screen story. I first met Mike when he was head of development for Barry and Enright. Mike also worked in that capacity for Disney and was VP of development at HBO and Once Upon a Time Productions. Over the years, Mike has developed hundreds of movie and television projects, often from initial concept to final cut. He has not only been an executive for these and other companies, but is himself a writer, something more development execs should try. Whose Chill Factor starred Cuba Gooding Jr. and the Dash Riprock named Skeet Ulrich. No matter what incarnation Mike Chitta appears under, executive, writer, or producer, wherever he goes, his magic story touch is the stuff of legend. Of the many scalps on his belt, Mike is the guy credited with cracking the story for the Patrick Swayze movie Next of Kin. Though it was a spec script purchase in the $1 million range, Next of Kin had problems that needed tweaking before it could get a green light, and it was Mike who solved them. Mike even showed me the place where this event occurred. One day we were taking a timeout from a story we were trying to break, bowed by despair and self-loathing over not knowing how. While walking through Century City, Mike stopped at the hallowed piece of sidewalk. "It was here," he said, Jacob Bronowski-like during a similarly meditative walk when his brain was filled with all the wrong ways to fix Next of Kin, that he'd come up with the right way. It just hit me. Cowboys and Indians. And indeed, when he presented this simple construct to the producers of Next of Kin, that's exactly what guided the rewrite. In the course of his career, Mike has had many such moments. Like some string theory physicist, he is always working on perfecting his story skills, often in ways that seem otherworldly, but almost always prove to be inspired. So when I ran into Mike recently and asked what new ideas he'd come up with, he pulled out an artist's sketchbook from his satchel and opened it with gleeful enthusiasm. The two halves of the sketchpad, its spiral binding running down the middle, offered a larger-than-normal field. Across both pages, he had drawn three straight lines demarcating four horizontal rows, and in the middle of these four equal rows were cut-out squares of paper. Each was a beat of the screen story he was working on. "It's portable," Mike cackled like a mad scientist. "Ah," I said, "the board." And we both nodded with the respect. The board. Chairman of the board. The board is perhaps the most vital piece of equipment a screenwriter needs to have at his disposal, next to paper, pen, and laptop. And over the years, whenever I've walked into someone's office and seen one on the wall, I have to smile because I now know what it is and the migraine in progress it denotes. Boards come in all types and sizes. Blackboards smeared with chalk, cork boards with index cards, and push pins to hold the beats in place, and even pages of a yellow legal pad scotch taped to hotel walls while on location in the attempt to rework a script on the fly. The board is universal. And yet of the screenwriting courses I know of, I've never really heard this useful tool discussed. So damn it, let's talk about it. I saw my first one on Mike Chitta's office wall at Berry & Enright 20 years ago. Naif that I was, though I'd already been paid actual money to write a few screenplays, I'd never seen the board, nor could I imagine what it would possibly be used for. Didn't you simply sit down and start and let the scenes fall where they may? Didn't you just let her rip? That's what I always did. But thanks to the chairman of the board, Mike Chitta, I learned not only the vital importance of planning a script by using the board, but how to use it to supercharge my results. Since that time, I have employed it often. In my case, I use a big cork board that I can hang on the wall and stare at. I like to get a pack of index cards and a box of pushpins and stick up my beats on the board and move them around at will. I have many decks of these index cards, rubber-banded and filed by project, of scripts written and yet to be. And all I need to do to revisit any of these scripts is take out the pack, deal them up on the board, take a look to know where I left off, and figure out if I need to call Mike. The board is a way for you to see your movie before you start writing. It is a way to easily test different scenes, story arcs, ideas, bits of dialogue, and story rhythms, and decide whether they work or if they just plain suck. And though it is not really writing, and though your perfect plan may be totally abandoned in the white heat of actually executing your screenplay, it is on the board where you can work out the kinks of the story before you start. It is your way to visualize a well-plotted movie, the one tool I know of that can help you build the perfect beast. But here are the most beneficial things about the board. A, it's tactile, and B, it wastes a lot of time. The exercise of working the board uses things other than your fingers on a keyboard. Pens, index cards, push pens. All things you can touch and see and play with at will. And did I mention how much time you can waste doing all this? You can spend a whole afternoon at Staples picking out just the right-sized board. You can spend the next morning figuring out where it goes on your wall. You can even go mobile with the index cards. You can pop that deck in your pocket, head out to Starbucks, take the rubber band off, and sit there and shuffle your cards for hours, laying out scene sequences, set pieces, and whammies. It's great. And the best part is, while you're doing all this seemingly ridiculous time-wasting work, your story is seeping into your subconscious in a whole other way. Have a great piece of dialogue? Write it on a card and stick it on the board where you think it might go. Have an idea for a chase sequence? Deal up them cards and take a look-see. And talk about creating a pressure-free zone. No more blank pages. It's all just little bitty index card-sized pages. And who can't fill up an index card? All well and good, but how does it apply to me, you ask? Me, me, me. All right, let's talk about you and your board. First cards first. Once you've bought the size and type of board you feel most comfortable with, put it up on the wall and have a look. It's blank, isn't it? Now take three long strips of masking tape and make four equal rows. Or if you're more daring, use a magic marker instead. Either way, it looks like this. Act 1, pages 1 through 25. Act 2, pages 25 to 55. Act 2, pages 55 to 85. Act 3, pages 85 to 110. Row 1 is Act 1, pages 1 through 25. Row 2 represents the first half of Act 2 up to the midpoint, 25 to 55. Row 3 is the midpoint to the break into Act 3, 55 to 85. And row 4 is Act 3 to the movie's final image, 85 to 110. It looks so easy, doesn't it? Well, it is. That's the whole idea. And after a couple of go-rounds using this tool, it will start to feel familiar, too. Soon, like a slot car racetrack, the corners and open sketches of this imaginary concourse will become well-worn and pleasing geography. You will quickly find that the ends of each row are the hinges of your story. The break into two, the midpoint, and the break into three are where the turns are. Each appears at the end of rows 1, 2, and 3. To my mind, this fits my mental map of what a screenplay is perfectly. And if you buy Sid Field's premise that each of the turns spins the story in a new direction, you see exactly where it occurs. Now in my hot little hand, I also have a crisp, clean, brand new pack of index cards. Oh, it's fun to unwrap the cellophane. And now with the help of a fistful of Pentels, not a Clint Eastwood movie, and my box of multicolored pushpins, I'm ready to put up my very first card. To waste as much time as possible, I usually neatly write the title of the movie on one such card and stick it up at the very top and take a step back. In a few weeks or months, the board is going to be covered with little bits of paper, arrows, color coding, and cryptic messages. For now, it's clean. Enjoy it while you can, lads. Okay, time to start. Although you can write anything you want on these index cards, they are primarily used to denote scenes. By the time we're done, you'll have 40 of these. Count them, 40, and no more. But for now, in this rough stage, we'll hang loose. Use as many as you want. And if you run out, you get to go back to Staples and waste more time. So go for it. What goes on your final 40 is very simple. Each card stands for a scene. So where does the scene take place? Is it an interior or an exterior? Is it a sequence of scenes, like a chase that covers several locations? If you can see it, write it with a magic marker. Interior, Joe's apartment, day. Each card should also include the basic action of the scene, told in simple, declarative sentences. Mary tells Joe she wants a divorce. More specific information will be noted later. In any storytelling venture, the most burning ideas you have for scenes are what must be laid out first. These are scenes you're sure are going to go into your movie. It's what made you want to write this puppy in the first place. For me, most often, these are funny set pieces, followed by that great scene where we introduce the hero and maybe the finale. Well, write each idea on a card and stick it up on the board where you think it goes. It may wind up in another place or may be cut out, But damn, it feels good to get those scenes off your chest. Yep, they're up there all right. And look at what you have. What you have is a whole lot of blank space. Gee, aren't you glad you didn't start writing? All those really great ideas that were burning to be written don't feel as big as you thought they were. And the story doesn't seem so likely to write itself once the ideas are written down and put up on the board. The great way the movie starts, or the chase at the middle, or the dramatic showdown that felt so full, so easy to execute in your head, isn't all that much stuff when you see it there naked. Up on the board, they're just a small part of the whole. But if you want to see these wonderful scenes come to life and have a reason to live, work must be done. Now the hard part begins. The major turns. The next cards you really must nail in there are the hinge points of the story. Midpoint, Act 2 break, Act 1 break. Since you have the advantage of the BS2, you know how vital these are. And even though you may come at it a whole other way, I always try to figure out the major turns first. I start with the midpoint. As discussed in the previous chapter, it's an up or down. Either your hero or heroes reach a dizzyingly false victory at page 55, or an equally false and dizzying defeat. In most cases, nailing the midpoint will help guide you, and it is the one decision you must make before you can go on. Most people can nail the break into Act 2. The setup you've got, and the adventure, or at least the beginning of it, is the movie in your head. But where does it go from there? The midpoint tells you, and that's why figuring it out is so important. With the midpoint nailed, the all is lost is not too hard to figure out. It's the flip of the midpoint. What about the up or down of the midpoint can be reversed to create its false opposite? And though it may take you some time to adjust both, give it a try. If you nail these two points, the break into three is usually cake. Now your board is starting to flesh itself out. Overloaded acts and black holes. For me, my biggest problem is mistaking the cards for something other than beats of the story, something other than actual scenes. This is especially true in the early going as I lay out the setup and the action of the first act. I give myself three or four cards for the first 10 pages. That's three or four scenes to get me to the catalyst. But a lot of times, what I'll see spread out there are 7 or 8 cards with things like the hero is a wrongly accused felon next to the hero is a saxophone player. Well, these are not scenes. This is backstory. And these cards will eventually be folded into one card labeled Meet the Hero during an actual scene in which he walks into a room and we see him for the first time. As stated in the previous chapter, a lot of this backstory, these character ticks and setups need to be set up. And all your great ideas will go on cards and just pile up there like BMWs on the 405 at rush hour. Never fear, it will all be pared down eventually. Point is to get it all out. This is the time to try anything, think of everything, and stick it all up there to see what it looks like. More confusion comes when scene sequences are laid out up on the board. Though things like a chase involve many scenes and can range through indoor and outdoor setups, it's actually only one beat. So what usually happens is you have 5, 6, 7 cards that are a sequence. One great part about using the board is the easy way you can identify problem spots. When you have a black hole, a place in your script that you can't figure out how to connect one chunk to another, you know it because it's staring you right in the face. All you have to do is look at the board and cry. And believe me, those black holes just sit there and taunt you, hour after hour, day after day. What's wrong, Blake? Can't figure it out? Got a little story problem? But at least you know where it is and what has to be done to fill in the blank spots. You've got 9 to 10 cards per row that you need to fill. And you have to figure it out. The Eternally Light Act 3. The funny part about laying out these cards is, in the early going, you almost always have a light Act 3. It's usually two cards, one labeled, the hero figures out what to do now, and the other labeled, the showdown. Ha, kills me every time I see it. And you always keep putting off fixing this. Not to fear. Eventually this too will give way. Your mind will flood with ideas, and Act 3 will begin to fill up. If not, then go back to Act 1 and look at all your setups and the 6 things that need fixing. Are these paid off in Act 3? If not, they should be. What about your B story? Whether it's the true love story or the thematic center of the movie, this must be paid off too. In fact, the more you think about tying up all the loose ends, the C, D, and E stories, recurring images, themes, etc., the more you realize all the screenplay bookkeeping that has to be accounted for in Act 3. Where else can it be done? What, you gonna pass out pamphlets at the movie theater? And what about the bad guys? Did you off all the lieutenants on your way to killing the uber-villain? Did all of the hero's detractors get their comeuppance? Has the world been changed by the hero's actions? Soon you will find your Act 3 crowded with cards and ideas to fill up the final scenes. 9 or 10 cards will be required to do this. Guaranteed. Color coding. Now here's a really cool thing, and it wastes a lot of time, but it's also important. How each character's story unfolds and crosses with others needs to be seen to be successfully worked out. This is where your Pentels come in. Color code each story. See what Meg's story cards look like written in green ink, and Tom's story cards are like written in red. And when you put them up on the board, you can see at a glance how the stories are woven together, or if they need to be reworked. This is one instance where you will not know how you lived before you used the board. And seeing these beats up there makes you realize what a potential nightmare it would be to try to figure this all out while writing. Screenplays are structure, precisely made Swiss clocks of emotion. And seeing your different colored stories woven together here makes you realize how vital this planning can be. But color coding can be used for other things, too. Story points that follow and enhance theme and repeating imagery can be color coded. Minor character arcs can be traced with your Pentels. C, D, and E stories can get the color code treatment. And once you have your multicolored cards in place, you can step back and see the genius of your design. All this is intended, of course, to ultimately save you time. What could be worse than being in the middle of actually writing your screenplay and dealing with these placement questions? It's a lot easier to see and move cards around on a board than chunks of your own writage that you've fallen in love with. It's a lot harder to kill your darlings by then. By organizing first, the writing is more enjoyable. Stripping it down. 40 cards, that's all I'm going to give you for your finished board. That's roughly 10 cards per row. So if you've got 50, or if you've got 20, you've got problems. Most likely you will have more than you need. And this is where the rubber meets the road, when you must examine each beat and see if the action or intent can't be folded into another scene or eliminated altogether. Like I mentioned previously, I usually have problem areas. Setup is a biggie for me. I have 20 cards sometimes in the first row. I think there is so much to say, so much I'm not getting across that I overcompensate. But then I look at how these beats can be cut out or folded into others. If I'm honest, if I really admit that I can live without some things, it starts to cut down. I get it down to 9 cards. And that's perfect. I will also have a lot of sequences, like chases or action set pieces that stray all over the place. This is easy to fix. Simply write chase on this section, no matter how many scenes, and consider it one beat. Usually that's all it is as far as advancing the plot is concerned. In areas where I'm light, like the problem area of bad guys close in, I usually cut myself some slack. And in some spots where I know I don't have all the answers, I occasionally even leave it blank and hope for a miracle during the writing process. But in the back of my mind, I know these areas will have to be addressed at some point. Laying it out lets me know where the trouble spots are. Plus, minus, and greater than, less than. Now that you have your 40 cards up on the board and you're pretty sure this is how your story goes, you think you're done, but you're not. Here are 2 really important things you must put on each card and answer to your satisfaction before you can begin writing your screenplay. One of the symbols is plus or minus. The other is the symbol greater than, less than. These 2 symbols should be written in a color pen you have not used and put at the bottom of each card. The plus or minus sign represents the emotional change you must execute in each scene. Think of each scene as a mini movie. It must have a beginning, middle, and an end. And it must also have something happen that causes the emotional tone to change drastically, either from plus to minus or from minus to plus, just like the opening and final images of a movie. I can't tell you how helpful this is in weeding out weak scenes or nailing down the very real need for something definite to happen in each one. Example, at the beginning of a scene, your hero is feeling cocky. He's a lawyer and he's just won a big case. Then his wife enters with news. Now that the case is over, she wants a divorce. Clearly, what started as a plus emotionally for your lawyer hero is now a minus emotionally. Believe it or not, an emotional change like this must occur in every scene. And if you don't have it, you don't know what the scene is about. Until you figure out the emotional change for each of the 40 cards using this simple plus or minus code, don't start. And if you can't figure it out, throw the card away. Odds are it's wrong. And while many, like Robert McKee, believe these pluses and minuses must be strung together, plus, minus, minus, plus, plus, minus, minus, plus, minus, to butt up against each other in an undulating wave of emotional highs and lows, I think that's taking it a little far. It's enough to know something has to change in each scene, and to show it. The other symbol, greater than, less than, denotes conflict. To understand what the conflict is, I always like to think of a scene like this. As the lights come up, two people walk into a room from opposite doors, meet in the middle, and begin to struggle past each other to reach the door on the other side. They each enter the scene with a goal, and standing in their way is an obstacle. That's conflict. And whether it's physical or verbal or simply a guy who really needs to pee and must get to a bathroom soon or else, that conflict must be foremost on your mind when you conceive each scene. The basic setups of man versus man versus nature, and man versus society that you learned in high school English class can all be applied here. When each scene opens, you must know what the main conflict of that scene is and who is bucking against whom. Each person or entity has an agenda. What is it? And how does it collide with the person or entity he or she must get past? The symbol greater than less than on the bottom of each card must be filled in with who each of the players is in each scene of conflict, what the issue is, and who wins by the end. If it's more than one person or issue, you've got a muddy conflict. And your scene is probably muddy too. Only one conflict per scene, please. One is plenty. And whether it's a large issue or a small one, something physical or something psychological, it must be there. Every scene, every time. If you can't find a conflict, figure out a way to create one. The reason having conflict is so important and must be in every scene is, once again, very primal. There's that word again. And thinking primally by having conflict in every scene guarantees that you will keep the audience's attention. Why? Well, we like to see people in conflict. Conflict gets our attention. Why is wrestling the longest-running drama on TV? It's about as basic an entertainment as you can get. Death. Two people trying to kill each other. Why do most movies have a romance? Again, the conflict is eternally primal and fascinating. Sex, two people trying to bed each other. At its core, every scene in your movie must be as basic as this in order to get and keep the viewer's attention. If you don't have the players in the greater than versus less than matchup your scene represents, you don't have the scene yet. So, find the conflict, or reassess, or dump it. And if you do, don't cry. It's only a card. Ready to let it fly. By the time you're done, you should have 9 cards in a row. Number 1, 9 in a row. Number 2, 9 in a row. Number 3, and 9 in a row. Number 4. Wait, that's only 36 cards. Well, I'm giving you 4 extra for those scenes I know you can't live without. Stick these wherever you like. We don't have to be that precise. But 40 is all that you get, or need. You do not get points for having the most perfectly laid out board. And as much fun as it is to play with these cards and fantasize about the ebb and flow of your story, there is a point where you must ask yourself, am I in the board building business or am I a screenwriter? If your board is too perfect, or if you spend too much time trying to make it so, then you have left the world of preparation and entered the procrastination zone. Well, don't. In fact, I always like to start writing when I'm coming up on the end of finishing the board, just before it gets too perfect. Like a jello mold that's not quite set. You want to start before it hardens. By then, I'm obsessed with pushpins and index cards, and I know it's time to stop.